This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 153, It's Not a Magic Pill. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Tommy Kraft. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the idea of a Captain Worf television series, William Shatner's new documentary about the making of The Next Generation, and thoughts on the DS9 finale from those who created it. Then in the feature, we're joined by Sebastian Pruth and Eric Brazier to discuss the Enterprise episode, Dear Doctor. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Tommy. Welcome to The Ready Room. It's great to have you back on the show. It's been quite a while. You've been so busy working on Prelude to Axanar. I wanted to give you space on that. That's done. You're back working on Horizon full-time now, I understand. So how's everything going?
It's going well. Thank you for having me and for giving me space, because it was insanely busy with Axanar and still with Horizon, my own project, because Axanar was their digital compositor. Mm-hmm. And so that meant I had to do all of the CG backgrounds for any time you saw a shot of a person. The only one I didn't do was Archer Arena, when we saw Ramirez, Tony Todd, speaking to the audience. But otherwise, so it was close to 200 shots that I had to composite, and it had to be done in less than a week.
Wow.
So basically it was like, you know, slam into full gear, not doing anything else. Day and night working on that, compositing, rendering, doing CG backgrounds. And then, of course, when it was done, you know, sending it for any final edits that they could approve or disapprove of, and then mailing out a hard drive to them so that they could get it last minute and so on.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's a good thing you got that new hardware recently.
Yeah.
To burn through that, so...
Yeah, definitely. And it has helped so much with both Axanar and Horizon, because I got this dual 6-core computer with 64 gigs of RAM, which actually means with hyper-threading, I have 24 cores, which just sounds awesome.
Sounds like it's running the Enterprise.
It pretty close could be. One of my favorite things to do is to run a render and then go into the task manager and tick off a couple cores from 3ds Max. So that way I can let Max render in the background now, you know, an animation that takes like 60 hours, and then go do other stuff. Like there's one rendering right now while we're recording.
Wow. Well, this reminds me, I'm going to have you on Continuing Mission soon and talk about the process of rendering scenes for these films. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to, because it's especially, I mean, since I've been done with Axanar, it's what I've been doing on Horizon nonstop. And there's a lot to talk about, for sure.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And the work on Prelude to Axanar was fantastic. It's been getting rave reviews, so great job on that.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into news here. And this first story is sort of, it's an older story, but it's one that's resurfaced. And this is about Michael Dorn and the Captain Worf TV series. So last year at Star Trek Las Vegas in 2013, there was an interview recorded with Michael Dorn. And the interview was finally uploaded to YouTube just a couple of weeks ago, on July 11th, actually. So maybe about a month ago. And that brought it back into the news here. And since I was having you on the show today, and because you actually are producing your own film based on Enterprise, I wanted to get your thoughts on the idea of this series, first of all, and the idea of someone other than CBS possibly doing it, which is, I think, where Michael Dorn is thinking with this as well. He mentions that in his comments.
Well, I mean, it would certainly be nice, but I think the chances are slim to impossible. that CBS would ever pick this or anything else up. You know, Renegades has been, ever since, I think since they started, at least for a long time, and going on about how they want to get picked up by CBS. And yeah. I've seen people make comments that CBS should pick up Axanar and do mm-hmm. a series. And the problem is that part of the problem is you're going to start setting a precedent then that, you know, you're suddenly going to have all these people flooding in doing fan projects saying, right. pick me up. Mm-hmm. But the other issue is that you don't really know what you're getting when you just pick up a group of people from the internet. And having been now behind the curtain, as they say, working on these things, and that is not just on my own projects, but working on other things like Axanar, it really would not be beneficial for a studio to approach a team like this and say, hey, make us a TV show. So that mm-hmm. more than anything is just not going to happen.
Do you think that the idea though behind these is not exactly that, but it's, here's what we can do. Now take our concept and maybe bring us in, but add to that other people and all of your resources as well, and then let this be the premise for a series that you would produce as the studio?
That would be more likely, but I still think it's highly unlikely, because I thought this too when the Enterprise Season 5 campaign started. I really would love to see that, of course, Season 5, but I don't think, unless CBS wants to, they're ever going to pick anything up, unless, no matter how many letters people write. You know, I like Worf as much as the next guy, but they look at J.J. Trek as Star Trek now. And right. I think the chances of picking up anything that is from the past era of Star Trek are very slim. Yeah. And so you might see, something where Worf, Michael Dorn, it goes with some independent filmmakers like Axanar and does that, but I don't think CBS would do it.
Yeah, and that's my other question for you, because I agree with you. I think that no matter how well produced a fan series or film is, I don't think CBS would pick it up, because the studio is just going to want to do their own thing. That's my feeling. And I do think, like you said, I don't necessarily think they're going to go Abrams-verse when they do a new show. They may, but I think that whatever they do, it'll be something different. It won't be a continuation of what we've seen before. It won't use characters that we know from the past, like Worf. But the other question I had for you is what you just finished with there. Michael Dorn suggested that fans write to CBS to show their interest, and he said it really takes a true letter-writing campaign. I don't think it can be a Kickstarter or one of those things. I don't want to do that. I think it has to be a grassroots movement that is so big that they just can't ignore. And if they do ignore it, somebody else may go, I'll do that. So two parts of what he said here. First, the Kickstarter thing I agree with. I don't think a Kickstarter is going to be taken seriously by CBS. People tweet at us a lot and they say, what would it take? Would it take a Kickstarter to get CBS to do a new Star Trek series? And I think, no, I think that that's not something that they're going to look at as a serious call for a TV series, just because the realities of budget of producing something through a Kickstarter versus an actual television series are different. You know, it's not something they would see there. But what he says at the end here, somebody else may go, I'll do it. Could you see someone, maybe the way that Alec has done with Axanar, where he's brought in Gary Graham, who's actually playing Saval from Enterprise, reprising the exact same character, hooking up with Michael Dorn and actually making not a TV series per se, but maybe, you know, 3 or 4 episodes of a Captain Worf story, some sort of mini arc, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking with a Kickstarter, because realistically, that's about the only way you're going to get the money to fund this if you want to do it independently, because it is really a very expensive process. And as you mentioned, it's much more expensive if you're actually going to do a TV show, because even back when Enterprise was on, there was like $30 million at the minimum for a season. Right. And so the amount of money you're going to raise on Kickstarter is just not even going to cover one episode, usually. And but independently, it could be done. And I think having the, if they, especially if they have other names, that helps get a lot of money too. But you also need people attached that are really good. You know, for instance, some of the latest clips we've seen out of Renegades have had some issues. And it's clear, I think, that no matter how much money you have, it's not necessarily going to equal a great product. And so it sometimes it's hit or miss. You know, it could be done, but will it actually be good? Will anybody other than Star Trek fans, diehard Star Trek fans, watch it? I don't know. That's that's the hard question. And I think that's also why CBS probably isn't going to pick something up, because it's just diehard Star Trek fans that are writing in letters.
Right.
And there just aren't enough of those that are going to, that are out there to equal a profit. And that's the problem too with independent producing of a feature like this, is you can't make money.
Yeah, you can't make money. Yeah, you're not allowed to. So
right, yeah. Even if you do well on Kickstarter, it has to go into the production budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can't be, you can't be making a living off of this.
Right.
And so you'll find that maybe you'll get somebody who'll do it once, but to do something continuing of that high caliber of quality, I just don't think it's feasible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I agree there. I do think that it's possible that they could do one or two episodes with the Kickstarter, and
right,
they could bring in the right people, perhaps. So that's feasible. But as a TV series, yeah, I don't see it happening either.
Well, part of the problem too is just, you know, as a side, that it's the way the money is spent in these things, that a lot of people, like these bigger fan films, Axanar included, is they get these Star Trek names, but they still have to pay them. They pay their actors. And that's kind of a problem in some ways, because you're paying your actors a good chunk of money, but nobody else is getting paid on the project. So there are a lot of issues with it, to say the least, for a long-term project. I could see maybe one independent feature being done, but yeah, long-term.
Yeah.
Pipe dream.
Well, we will see. It sounds interesting anyway. So I don't know if it'll resurface or not. Again, this is actually an older story that just resurfaced here. And
right,
the fact that it hasn't played out yet is sort of an indication, I think, that it probably won't.
There's the issue, too, of is his script any good? Because he's not known for being a writer. I mean, he could be a really good writer, but, you know, no one else has really seen this yet. So we don't even know if the script would make a great show.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We don't know. So, well, let's go on to the next thing here. Just while we're talking about funding, this is a quick little plug for us here on the network. We love making these shows for everyone every week. And we put them out there for everyone to download for free. But of course, it isn't free for us to produce these shows. It actually costs quite a bit. I mean, just our hosting and distribution alone every month is $500 or more. So it does add up. And we would like to give everyone a chance to be more a part of the network and help support what we're doing here. And we've set up our new home on Patreon. Now, for those of you who don't know about Patreon, it's a lot like Kickstarter, which we've just been talking about here with the Michael Dorn story, except it's a way for you to contribute to creatives on a monthly basis. And we have goals there, things we're trying to do right now. We have benefits. We have different contribution levels. We have benefits, and it's outlined what you get in return for your support of the network. We have a lot of things there, you know, including a chance for you to get producer credits, for you to sit in on show recordings of your favorite shows, also for you to chat with us privately, take part in some special podcasts, and many other things. We have lots of different benefits for you there, and those could be changing along the way as well, and they're all outlined there on the page. So if you would like to find out how you can support us, a very easy way to do it, and it's, you know, just everyone says the cost of a cup of coffee, right? Well, it's that for sure. No more than that, but we have many different levels, and any little bit helps us out greatly here on the network. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And you'll find our page there. We're going to have exclusive content, actually, that's available there on Patreon only. Some short behind-the-scenes briefings and tidbits from people from the world of Star Trek. I just sat down with Larry on Saturday. Larry and I recorded a few bits going back to the finale of DS9, as well as a little bit of talk, finale of Enterprise, finale of Voyager. And these bits are going to be available only to our Patreon supporters there on the Patreon page. And those will be coming out soon as well. So keep your eye out there, patreon.com/trekfm. And we really thank you for any support that you can give us and help us keep the shows coming to you every week. Now, Tommy, the next story we have here is about William Shatner, who I love. He's done so many great documentaries in recent years, and he has a new one out called Chaos on the Bridge, which is about the making of TNG in the tumultuous early seasons.
I think this sounds fantastic. And I, too, love William Shatner. I think he gets a bad rap from a lot of people, but he's a tremendous actor. And, you know, especially when he wants to bring it, he can. And I've really enjoyed his documentaries, too. The Captains was great. And so I think this will be really interesting, especially to see his take on these topics regarding TNG.
Yeah, it should be. The documentaries he has done so far have been great in learning more about what was going on behind the scenes, even with the actors themselves, you know, the Captains. Today's an Enterprise show, and I love in the Captains when he talked to Scott Bakula, because you really get a feel for who Scott Bakula is coming into that. What's interesting to me, Tommy, about this is that, now, of course, William Shatner is Canadian, as everyone knows. This is going to be premiering on August 25th, so 2 weeks from the day we're recording this show, about a week from the time the show will actually come out to everyone. It's premiering in Canada at 9 p.m. Eastern, August 25th, but not in the U.S., and the production company is currently working on finding a U.S. distributor. Is this weird to you, especially after we've had the Captain's close-up and the full Captain's documentary, that he wouldn't already have Epix or someone else as a U.S. distributor for a documentary like this?
Yeah, I mean, is it that he can't find anyone to pick it up?
I don't know. I don't know the whole behind-the-scenes story to that. I just know that the distributor, the production company in Canada, is looking for a distributor. U.S. distributor.
Yeah, I mean, that is interesting because after it premieres in Canada, it's going to hit the internet. Yeah. And one way or another, people are going to see it. And so you'll lose a lot of potential viewers on a, you know, mm-hmm. in a ratings game on TV. So I would probably chalk that up just to bad management on the part of the distribution company.
Yeah, it seems that way. It's really odd to me. Like, I get the Canadian premiere and William Shatner being Canadian and all, kind of. Although Star Trek, more than anything, I mean, it's a global franchise, but it's a Hollywood production. So it's sort of, it's an American creation. You would think that people would be, just if someone just told you, William Shatner wants to do a documentary about the making of The Next Generation, and he's going to sit down with Ira Stephen Baer, he's going to sit down with Gates McFadden, he's going to sit down with writers like Melinda Snodgrass, who wrote The Measure of a Man, and we see him with all of these people in screenshots that have been provided to Trek Movie by the production company. If someone told you that, wouldn't you say, I want this documentary on my network?
Yeah, and I would expect it primarily to premiere here. And in fact, I'm even going to let a little secret out to you. Don't tell anyone, but I did not know William Shatner was Canadian.
So, really?
Yeah. And so that kind of surprised me when he told me that. And it surprised me more that the premiere was going to be in Canada because, I mean, heck, the Vulcans even landed in Montana. Right. So, yeah, exactly.
Speaking of Canada and Vulcans, and we were talking about Kickstarter earlier. This is actually an Indiegogo campaign, but have you seen the new campaign from Vulcan Alberta, Canada on Indiegogo to build a real enterprise? And their goal is $2 billion to start.
I have not seen that. Is this supposed to be like a joke, or are they actually trying to do it?
Well, I think they would really love to do it. I don't know. Right. I'm going to have them on to talk to them soon and find out behind it. And I don't know if it's more about publicity. The first application of the money is to fund scientific research into warp technology.
So now, see, this excites me. I have to learn more about this because one of my greatest goals in life is to get rich so I can fund warp research. I'm not even kidding you. And so I have to know more about this. I want to figure this out, and I want to give them the 2 pennies I have in my bank account so they can give me warp drive.
Well, just go to Indiegogo, which I guess is Indiegogo.com, right? Indiegogo, I believe.com. And search for Build the Enterprise or Vulcan. I think it'll come right
up.
You can see it. So yeah, he is Canadian. But back to the story here, the official description is, in William Shatner Presents Chaos on the Bridge, William Shatner, the original Captain Kirk, takes an intimate look at the recreation of an iconic television series through the eyes of the writers, producers, actors, and executives who were involved, many of whom have never before told their story on film. Directed by William Shatner, who also conducts the interviews, what emerges is a tale of power struggles, ego clashes, and most importantly, the legacy of the man behind the legend, Gene Roddenberry. The approach is interesting because it sort of describes the making of the original series as well and what went on through that after that. And I'm kind of wondering how he approaches it. Like, did he go in trying to find problems, or is he going to approach it in more of, this was going on behind the scenes and isn't it amazing what came out of it? Because it is fairly well known, I think, to most fans that the first couple of seasons of TNG were uneasy anyway. And, you know, what was the vision going to be? How was it going to come together? There were some struggles. I always feel like the cast got on really, really well. So I think maybe more ego clashes maybe were behind the scenes with the studio or with Gene or something. I'm not sure. So it will be interesting to hear.
I think I wouldn't think he would necessarily go into it looking for problems, but especially with something that has the legacy of Star Trek, and even at that point had started to gain such a legacy, you're going to find that there's going to be quite a wide range of egos and not egos. And I would not be surprised at all to find out that there was a lot of dirt, you know, on a lot of skeletons in the closet from that time. Because a lot of people, when you ask them questions about how is it working with so-and-so or how is it working on this show, they give you the PR answers of, oh, it was great, it was wonderful. But but then if you're personal friends with one of them and you ask them that question and they just, you know, talk trash up one side and down the other. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's never a happy medium. And so I would be very interested to see or to hear and see the things that he found out, both good and bad, and the things that he talks about on that documentary.
Yeah, same here. So I hope they find not only an American distributor, but I hope that this is made available internationally because, you know, I had problems. It took me a long time to see The Captains. It took me a long time to see Trek Nation when Rod put that together because of the distribution issues, you know, with me being in Japan. So hopefully this will be available where I'll be able to see it soon as well, because I'm really looking forward to it. So I'll put a link in the show notes. Go over to trekmovie.com if you want to see the photos. They have some photos that the production company sent them. And it certainly looks good in the photos. And Shatner is great at sitting down and interviewing people.
Yeah, so he is.
It will be great on that front, if nothing else, I know.
He's a surprisingly good interviewer, too. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect that from watching. You wouldn't expect that from just an actor, but he's really taken to that role quite well.
He really, really has. So, all right. Well, the last thing that we have here in news, Tommy, is to remind everyone. I talked about it on Hyper Channel. I don't know if I talked about it on the Ready Room, but every year, Larry Nemechek and I put together a CD called Trekland on Speaker, and these are portions of interviews that Larry did with writers and actors and creatives and all sorts of people from the world of Star Trek at the time that the shows were being produced. So as most fans know, Larry was for a long time the editor of Star Trek Communicator. And in writing those articles, he would go and he would sit down and talk to the creatives about what was happening with the show and as episodes were being developed. And Larry has boxes and boxes and boxes of cassette tapes in his studio with these interviews on them. And he's been digitizing them, getting them into the computer before the tapes go bad, because some of them are from the 80s. So they really are not in great shape. And so what we do is we take segments of those interviews and we restore them as best we can. Remember, these are recorded with a tape recorder, cassette tape player being put on a table in between two people in a room, you know, with air conditioner and everything running. And just you hit record and you talk, and never intended to be released to the public. So the one that we have out now, Tommy, this premiered at Star Trek Las Vegas, and Larry now has it available on his website for purchase, so anyone who wants it can go there and get it. This one is called What They Left Behind. It's about DS9's finale, and he sits down with Ronald D. Moore, with Ira Steven Behr, also with Dan Curry, who was visual effects producer, and Gary Hutzel, who was visual effects supervisor, and talks to them about the writing of What You Leave Behind.
That sounds really interesting, actually. And DS9 being my second favorite to Enterprise, and DS9 having my favorite finale, I would be really interested in hearing that.
What's really fascinating about all of these Trekland on speaker discs is that when we hear them talk about it now, like say the Enterprise Blu-rays, for example, they've got Brannon sitting in there and he's talking about Enterprise now. What's interesting is on these discs to hear them talking about it in the moment with all the stress of everything that was going on.
Right, that's true, yeah.
What's really fascinating is, you know, Ira sort of foreshadowing what people would do with Sisko and the DS9 characters in the literary universe down the road.
Yeah.
But he's talking about it in 1999 before What You Leave Behind aired, but after they had written it and they were shooting it. And wow, I mean, this guy knows his stuff.
Maybe he really is a prophet.
He may be. Know? He may be. That might be what the blue beard is. That's how you know
right,
he's a prophet.
Yeah.
So go and check these out, everyone. You can still get Volume 2, which was all about All Good Things, the TNG finale, and Volume 3, which is about the DS9 finale. And Volume 1 is currently out of print. It's going to be available soon in digital format, so stay tuned on that one. But you can go over to Larry's website right now. They're $21.99 each, with free shipping in the U.S. and Canada, $3.50 per disc international shipping. You can get 2 and 3 together, Volumes 2 and 3 together, for $39.99. It's still free shipping domestically. It's international $7 because there are two discs, but you do save $4 that way if you want to get both. And they're really worth the listen. It's really fascinating. It's not recorded with pristine audio equipment because it wasn't recorded today. We'll clean them up the best we can, but the content is just invaluable.
Yeah, I would, even though the quality isn't quite there, I would definitely like to take a listen to that, especially as a filmmaker myself, you know, to be able to get that insider track on what they were thinking at the time. I'm going to have to go buy it now.
Yeah, definitely pick it up. They're fantastic. Well, that's all we have in news today, Tommy, before we jump into the feature, where we're going to be joined by Sebastian Pruth and Eric Brazier to talk about the Enterprise episode, Dear Doctor. We would like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They're the best source of audiobooks that you'll find anywhere, as we tell you every single week. I've been a customer for 14 years, so I can personally vouch over and over for how great Audible is. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, pick whatever book you want, absolutely free. And as this is a Star Trek show, we like to recommend books to you every week. And instead of a novel this week, though, Tommy, because we were talking about William Shatner and his documentary earlier, I wanted to recommend Shatner Rules, Your Key to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large. This was written, I want to say it was like 2 years ago, from William Shatner. Have you read this or have you heard the audiobook?
I have not, but it sounds like something I need to right away.
You do. Okay, so, boy, this is an expensive show for you today, Tommy. You're
going
to have to go get Larry's disc. You're going to have to go get this. But, of course, you can get this free if you're not an Audible customer already.
Right.
This book is, it's just fantastic. Have you heard movie memories or Star Trek memories, the ones they did a long time ago?
No, I haven't actually.
Okay, you got to hear those as well.
Add those to the list.
Add those to the list. What is great about the audiobooks with William Shatner is that he narrates them himself. But right. Whereas with a lot of audiobooks, you have a narrator who's reading a story to you. It's not like that with Shatner. It's like he's just sitting down with you and just telling you this story. And here you go, Tommy. This is what this book is about. It says, admit it. You want to be William Shatner. This collection of rules, illustrated with stories from Bill's illustrious life and career, will show you how Bill became William Shatner, in all caps, larger than life and bigger than any role he ever played. Shatner Rules is your guide to becoming William Shatner, or more accurately, beautifully Shatner-esque.
This guy has no shame. That's what I love about him.
But yet it's endearing, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how he does it. Like, if I did that, people would like slap me upside the head and call me really arrogant.
I know. It's like, if anyone else did the things that he does, you would think, this guy's really pompous, right?
Right.
Really arrogant. But for me anyway, when William Shatner does it, there's something endearing about it. And I just think he's great.
Yeah, I do too. I agree.
So I highly recommend this book. I have the audio version of it, and there's stories about his career and about his life and how he got to where he is. And I actually think that anyone can listen to this and actually gain some great advice on how to approach life and help them achieve the things they want to achieve by listening to this.
Yeah, well, advice is universal. I mean, whether you're going into the film industry or the sciences or business, there are some things that a person who's had success can share with you that are applicable anywhere. And I would certainly count William Shatner in that category of somebody who's had success and might Absolutely. Have a few good things to pass on.
Absolutely. And on the cover, he's holding the entire world in his arms. So.
He had a movie about like with that same kind of thing too. How William Shatner changed the world. Yeah,
right. And there was Shatner's World that he did the tour as well, and the artwork for that was also him with the big globes.
Yeah.
Actually, this book came out very close to the same time that tour was going on. So,
oh, okay, yeah. Cool.
All right. So again, you can get this absolutely free. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. And when you do that, it really does help us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week as well. So we really thank Audible for their support of the show. And we thank you for supporting Audible. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. In the vast majority of Star Trek episodes, we know that our crews are being guided by Starfleet General Order 1, or the Prime Directive. It's Starfleet's highest law and a framework for interacting with alien cultures. Captain Archer had no such directive to guide his actions, and the need for one became very obvious in the first season Enterprise episode, Dear Doctor. Today we're going to talk about this episode, and to help us do that, from Star Trek, The Continuing Mission, and the production company that sounds way too hot to touch, Melting Clock, we're joined by Sebastian Pruth. Sebastian, welcome back.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you back. And also joining us again from the Trek About podcast is Eric Brazier. Hey, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Good to have you here. So today we're going to talk about Dear Doctor, one of my favorite Enterprise episodes. In fact, one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. Before we get into the discussion, a quick synopsis for those who have not seen this episode or haven't seen it in a while. The Enterprise is traveling through space. This is first season, so they're just exploring, and they encounter a ship that is not warp capable. They bring the aliens aboard. They find out that they are suffering from a disease. They take them back to their home world, and then Archer is faced with a dilemma. They find out that there are two humanoid species who are both sentient, living on this planet. One is dying, and one is treated sort of as subhuman or humanoid, as I always say on here, by the dominant race. And Archer is faced with whether or not to give medication and a cure to these aliens. Also, whether or not to give them warp capability, which they ask for. At the same time, Phlox is learning to live amongst humans and is also faced with a choice between hiding his research results from Captain Archer or maybe going against his captain's wishes. So it's a very interesting episode, and we'll talk about the decisions that were made as we go along. So, Eric, why don't you kick us off here with your initial thoughts on this episode?
Yeah, so this is actually this Star Trek Enterprise is the Star Trek that I'm least familiar with, but this episode always sort of stands out in my mind, I think, for two reasons. Number one, it's very similar to an episode of TNG that I really like, Data's Day, in that he's writing a letter to someone else, and it sort of structures the entire episode. And the other reason, I think, is because it's a very strong early example of Enterprise doing the sort of social commentary that I really like in Star Trek. And I think that they do a really good job of sort of laying the groundwork for a lot of what comes in the later Star Trek series and in the Federation as a whole.
Yeah, I agree very much. What about you, Sebastian?
Well, you know, Dear Doctor always stands out for me as well as being probably one of the first season's best example of a Star Trek story, being a Star Trek story, something which asks a question, how do we deal with this? Because it's very uncomfortable and we don't know what to do and we can't tell right from wrong. And Star Trek always shines a light into that dark hole and says, okay, these are the elements that says, and you have to make up your own decision. And Dear Doctor was really good at that because it forced us to be on the side of the doctor just by being through his perspective, because it's a letter that he's writing to his friend. And Archer almost comes across like your enemy in this episode. Like, oh, okay, you know, he wants to do something, but I'm really on the side of the scientist because I believe the scientist. Now, maybe that's me because I'm more of a scientist kind of person. But I always look at this episode as for most of the episode, Archer is kind of across the line from Phlox. And then by the end of the episode, it's like, I came close to misjudging Captain Archer. And all of a sudden, everything's hunky-dory again, and they can keep going. But now they've learned something about each other, which they can use for the rest of their relationship, which is one of the cool things about all the setup in the first season.
Interesting points. Yeah, I'm more of a scientist type myself, although I don't know if I would ever describe Archer as almost being the enemy in this episode.
So, well, I know so much mean like the enemy, like combatant or something, but like the enemy as in he's completely against Dr. Phlox's point of view. He is the other side of the argument for much of the episode. And if you really want to look at it, you're really not out there to play God. And he finally gets to that point of view when he starts talking about the eventual Prime Directive. But he takes some getting there, and I think he almost takes too much getting there for how much humanity should have evolved by then, but that's just me.
Okay. What about you, Tommy?
Pretty much what the others said, actually. It's just a really great example of how to write a 40-minute TV episode, and on top of that, it's a really great episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, I think this is one of... If I'm taking all of Star Trek, all the series together, and I'm picking, I don't know, 25, 30 episodes, I would probably put this in that group, even though it's first season Enterprise, because I just think that the message they're talking about and its implications for later Star Trek and the Prime Directive are so important, and it's so well put together that I think it's a prime example of what Star Trek is about and when it's done well.
It's Enterprise's version of Who Watches the Watchers.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, Eric, Data's Day. And I actually, in terms of pulling you into the story and making you feel like you're really part of what's going on in his head and in this letter, I almost feel like John Billingsley pulls this off better as Phlox than Brent Spiner does as Data in that sense.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, you know, John Billingsley, I think, is one of the more underrated Star Trek actors. You know, he, I think he had the bad misfortune of it being on the least successful Star Trek show, if you discount the original series, at least in its primetime run. But he's, you know, one of the things that really struck me rewatching Dear Doctor is just how good he is as an actor, and how interesting of a character Phlox really is. I would put Phlox up there with a lot of my other favorite Star Trek characters, and I don't think I could, I would do that for a lot of other Enterprise characters.
I noticed the same thing when I went back and rewatched this, just how good his performance was. Because even like at the end, when Hoshi gives him a little pat on the arm when she says, get out of sick bay, you know, to get cheered up or to get his mind off things. He does this little gesture where he just rubs off his arm after she does that, because he's not used to people touching him. And right. I've seen this episode, I don't know how many times before, but I've never noticed that. And it's little things, you know, that I noticed that going through the episode this time like that, that add so much to the performance.
Also, when he's listening to the letter from Dr. Lucas, and Dr. Lucas is talking about the Nobulan mating season, and he says, you make us look like single-celled organisms. And John Billingsley just gives this kind of little look with his face in his hand.
Yeah.
It's just that. It was just so natural there. Well, let's, before we get into the serious part of this, let's talk about movie night a little bit. I love that this episode starts off with movie night. And Tommy, do they have movie night on the NX-04 Discovery?
They do, but they watch things, you know, like The Matrix and Star Wars. So, okay.
What happens when they have that scene with the guy from Star Trek who was also in Star Wars? How do you handle that?
The universe rips apart, and there's like a fold in space, and suddenly everything just goes haywire.
A Tychon's Rift?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I actually thought movie night was really funny because I had forgotten that Enterprise did this. And you know, one of the things I appreciate about Enterprise is that they try and make the people seem more like us than, you know, the people from 200 years in the future. And I'm not exactly sure what movie they're watching in this episode, which I am kind of embarrassed about because I used to be a film person many years ago. So I don't know what they're watching. But it was kind of weird because it seems to me like they're watching, you know, if you look at this as being in 2151, this is like 200 years in the past. So in a sense, it's kind of strange that they would all be really getting into this really old movie. It's kind of like people nowadays, you know, watching something from 1800 and getting really invested in it. But, you know, I like that it's sort of, it also provides a good thematic tie-in with what the Doctor is doing, because of course in the early part of the episode he's talking a lot about how he's trying to observe the humans on the Enterprise and how he's getting really invested in their emotions and sort of learning about them. And so, you know, I like little things about it where they really do make him seem alien. Like, he's not interested in watching the movie. He's interested in finding about if there's going to be what he calls a group emotional response, for example.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's interesting you bring up watching movies from, you know, those older movies from the mid-1900s. Because that's something I thought about, too. It's like, why do they only watch those old movies? And, of course, it's copyright reasons. But in-universe, why do they do it? And
they actually talk about it sometimes, though. They talk about later movies.
Yeah, that's true. They do. And you could also, you know, just say that, well, you know, today people still go see Shakespeare and so on, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, like if you, I think there was an episode, I think it was this here, I'm proving my geekdom here. I think it was the beginning of Twilight when Archer and T'Pol are talking before that thing happens where he can't form new memories. The whole conversation is about Rosemary's Baby.
Is it? I don't remember that.
Yeah,
and also they talk about spaghetti westerns. They talk about they do talk about later, more colorized and, you know, more modern films.
Right.
And I think they can only really mention them because unless it's a Paramount movie, they're going to have a lot of trouble showing any of it.
Yeah. So I also think movie night is a great touch, even if they are watching those older movies. I think it's kind of cool actually that they, even in the 22nd century, they still appreciate work that was done way back then. Movie night leads us to the next topic that I'd like to talk about, which is cultural understanding, which is a big theme in this episode, even though the episode is primarily about the need for a prime directive and the tough decisions that Archer has to make. And during movie night, we see Phlox there with crewman Cutler. And then the great scene when they're walking back to her quarters. And that leads on through the episode, especially to the point where they're down on the planet on Valakis, and he tells her about his wives and talks to her about kind of picking up these signals from her. And the reason he tells her is because of cultural understanding, and he sees how she's reacting and the other humans are reacting to what's happening with this culture. We also see Phlox interacting with Hoshi and with T'Pol and, of course, with Archer and Porthos. Even Phlox knows that you shouldn't give Porthos too much cheese. So, but he finds it interesting, the connection, you know, between humans and dogs and how they form these connections. So what did you guys think about the cultural understanding moments here and how even early in, this is early in Enterprise, so we really are still seeing the aliens, Denobulans, Vulcans, humans on the ship, learning to live together and understand each other's cultures a little bit more.
Well, there's a really good line in this episode where when he's writing to Dr. Lucas back on Denobula, he says, the crew are growing accustomed to having an alien doctor around. And that always, every time I hear that line, I always think about it. How would I feel about an alien doctor? And I always come to the conclusion that it really wouldn't bother me. Because if he's a clever guy, he's got 15 degrees in interspecies medicine, he's qualified up the wazoo, this guy is probably more qualified than any human doctor to look after the humans, because he also has the perspective of not being a human, which is probably going to be good and bad, but he's so old and so wise, he knows how to be a doctor for humans. So there's that kind of cultural difference that I always look at with this episode. And then you kind of see, how does Phlox relate to each one of these characters? How does he relate to Archer? How does he relate to the authority figure? How does he relate to T'Pol, who's someone he considers kind of a kindred spirit on the Enterprise because she's also not human? And then, you know, how does he relate to the dog? Well, he thinks the dog in another episode is subservient and uninteresting and not something that needs to be cared about. And it takes Archer drawing that humanity out of him to realize that the dog is just as important as everybody else. So Phlox's mission, his journey as somebody who knows all the characters on the ship, takes place throughout the series. And I think this is kind of like the beginning of that for him. This is like him opening the book on every one of those characters and kind of learning a little bit more, and not to steal a potato from someone's plate just in the middle of dinner, which is what he did, I think, one of the earlier episodes.
Right.
But the question is, how would you feel if you were Phlox and you had to be the alien doctor amongst all the other humans? You know, that's it is always kind of a weird thing. I mean, even one time when I had to play guitar at a black church, like, it was just strange being in a completely different culture where, like, I was the only white guy there. And I don't say that from, you know, a racist standpoint. It's just such a culture shock. Like, how can it, like,
yeah, the
can
atmosphere
you
is different.
Yeah, can you imagine?
The style of worship is different.
Right, yeah. And can you imagine, like, being an alien, like a completely different race amongst the starship full of humans?
What is it he says, like, we're ridiculously compassionate? That even a movie can draw compassion from a human being, whereas that's ridiculous to him.
Yeah, he says they can empathize with fictional characters, and that Denobulans used to have movies until they realized that real life was more interesting, which is something that a lot of people say now, of course.
Which is sort of like a kick into the glass of the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me about, you know, the whole thing about Dr. Phlox being one of the only two aliens on a ship full of humans, and he seems delighted that he's able to sort of see them in their first, you know, interstellar voyage and all of these things. But, you know, they've got these sad moments in the episode, like he's sitting in the mess hall by himself and sort of expectantly looking around, like who's going to sit with him, like he's, you know, the unpopular kid at lunch. And it really made me think that, it's kind of a kind of a I guess kind of a problem that the humans don't really seem that interested in the aliens that are on the ship. They, you know, they're very interested in exploring, and they're very interested in going out and meeting new life and new civilizations, as of course we say in the Star Trek franchise. But they have new life there, and that they seem very uninterested in getting to know Dr. Phlox and T'Pol for that matter. I mean, certainly, you know, Hoshi and crewman Cutler are interested in Phlox, but most people don't seem very interested in finding out what his actual culture is like, or what he believes, or, you know, what even makes him laugh.
And it is a heartbreaking moment too, when he asked Malcolm to sit down with him, and he says, not right now, because we've all been that guy at the lunch table. He says, oh, sit down and have lunch with me. Oh, I can't.
And especially as Star Trek fans, right?
Right, yeah, I know.
So the other thing is, look at it from Malcolm's point of view. I know, and I'm never the guy who says look at it from the bully's point of view. But if you think about it, Phlox sometimes does some really weird stuff.
Yeah.
So if you're a human being on a ship with an alien and he steals from your plate, he brushes his tongue at night, he has incredibly long toenails, he's very strange,
yeah,
to them. I mean, he has that ridiculous digitally enhanced smile. And
just awesome.
Sounds like my neighbor.
The thing with Phlox is, you know, like if you were Malcolm, you'd be like, God, I don't know if I want to deal with that right now. I think I just want to go and have my crumpet in the in the weapons room.
Well, I can associate with Phlox in this case. I mean, I live in a culture where I look different than everyone else. You know, it's easy in the United States where if you come there, you're from somewhere else, it's very easy to blend in because everybody, it's a melting pot, right? Everybody looks different. Here, you really, really stand out. And talk about people doing things that are, these are not as weird as brushing your tongue or something. But, you know, say Japanese, there are always those people who are very interested in someone who's from another country. And they're going to be like Hoshi or Crewman Cutler, and they're going to want to talk to you and find out more. And it's very interesting to them. But then as a whole, I would say people will be polite, but distant,
just and like that's they what are you here. See with,
yeah, right, and that's what you see with the crew on the NX-01 as well, where Phlox is concerned or T'Pol is concerned, and you know, but things like here, like if Americans are visiting here, one thing that's very common is they're very loud on the train, which is absolute no. Mm-hmm. That's a culture. That's a taboo here. You don't do that. You're on the train. You're quiet. Don't talk across seat to seat. You don't, you know, use the phone, the things like that. Wearing sunglasses, something you don't do here. You know, shorts, not so common on a train. So, like, people really stand out as being different. And so people will be polite but keep their distance. And only some people will be really fascinated and interesting. So I can associate quite well, you know, with Phlox here. Of course, I've been here so long. I would be like Phlox on the Enterprise after 18 years where he's completely blended in, you know, but this is Phlox on the Enterprise right here is like me in 1997, just arriving here.
Yeah. Not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the only crew members of the Enterprise who seems interested in Phlox, of course, is Hoshi, who is Japanese, mm-hmm. which I just find interesting because of your comment there.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. But she's fascinated with other cultures and languages, which is what led her to be a linguist in the first place.
And Cutler is Crewman Cutler is an exobiologist, which means she specializes mm-hmm. in the biology of other species. So it would make sense too that she would be interested in someone like Phlox. It
should also be pointed out that I think that Hoshi sought Phlox's help when she was very uncomfortable when they first started their mission, because mm-hmm. he was taking care of a extraterrestrial worm, which they had found.
Sluggo.
Yeah. And so maybe they formed some sort of bond there. And, you know, he was saying to her, maybe you need to go back to Earth, somewhere more comfortable that suits your environment. So he was kind of counseling her. So it's I see that their relationship blossomed from him reaching out to her rather than her reaching out to him.
Well, he's like the wise old man, really, on the ship. He is mm-hmm. the counselor, and I think that he was the most appropriate person who could put himself in her shoes, make her feel comfortable, and help her find what would be right for her, because unlike Archer, who needs her on his crew, Phlox can just look at like what's best for this individual person.
Right. And she's also, he's kind of like the wise old man, but he's, mm-hmm. he becomes later on in the series, he's kind of more like the humans because mm-hmm. he kind of rubs off on them. Like every other character in Star Trek, humanity rubs off on aliens, which I don't know if that how true that is, but it seems to be the kind of the prevalent story device.
Yeah, well, the stories are written by humans, so that's fine. Before we move off of this topic, I know we want to talk a little bit about Kelly Waymire and Crewman Cutler and how good she is in this episode. She's, of all the non-main cast on Enterprise, she's my favorite character. People know how much I love Loeffler on The Next Generation. I always say Cutler is my Loeffler of Enterprise. But I think this episode, as we were talking about on the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
Sebastian, you were saying how much this highlights what a great actress Kelly Waymire was. And of course, as many fans know, mm-hmm. and many others may not know, she was intended to be a much bigger part of Enterprise, a recurring character, but sadly, she died. And that's why she just disappears.
Yeah, I mean, to clarify, she passed away, not so much
sure,
on yeah. set or something like that, but she had a physical problem which was not detected, and then she just suddenly died, which is terrible at the age of 36, terribly young. But she was a very vibrant actress, and everybody loved her. She was cast as a guest on Voyager and brought in to do a 7th season episode, which is a really good one, where B'Elanna was on that planet and they all kind of, they communicated through a play and she helped the guy come up with the play. And she was one of the main aliens of the week on that. And then she came back and did Enterprise. And she did, I think she did like 3 episodes. Was this the last one she did?
She only did 2, didn't she? Wasn't it only earlier one in season 1 about the rock people?
She was in Strange New World, you know, right off the bat. Yeah.
Yeah. She was in the cave. She was in the Bronson Cave one. But I watched an interview with her today, which I had never seen before, because I was just trying to do a little research about this before we jumped in here. And there's like about 9 minutes interview with her on StarTrek.com. And she just comes across as such a great person. I mean, it really sucks to see somebody so young disappear.
Yeah, she actually did appear one more time after this in 2 Days and 2 Nights, the episode where they go to Ryza.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And then she's mentioned in Rygen, which is where they like mention because she's injured, and then that's it, and that's all for her. So,
but I think she had just passed away right when that episode was written. And I think that was kind of like a little nod to her.
Yeah, it's very very sad, but she's great on screen, and I think she's really excellent in this episode as well.
Yeah, she really adds a lot of life and I think flavor to this episode in particular. And I think you know the interactions that she has with Phlox are great, and she has these really nice little line readings. I always remember her line, "Let's just see where it goes," when they're on the planet and Phlox mm-hmm. is telling her about his 3 wives. Yeah. And you know, I think that could have been a very differently intended line, but she brings across such sort of a wry sense of humor and a kind of like, you know, maybe I'm in charge, maybe you think you're in charge, but I'm actually in charge of what's going on here. So mm-hmm. I really appreciated her.
You know, as they say, it takes 2 to tango, and John Billingsley is certainly great, but if she had not been able to get those interactions down, it just wouldn't have worked. And she managed to play that role in that line of being friendly / a little bit flirty / just wanting to hang out with the doctor so well that it never came off as weird or, you know, like she really wanted to be with him or anything. It just came off as like this really genuine person who wanted to be friends with the doctor. She did that really well, I thought.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on and talk about Archer and how he learns. He's a learning captain here, and we're actually watching the captain of the ship absorb what's happening around him and make course adjustments, as in his mind he tries to make some very difficult decisions without the help of the Prime Directive. And towards the end of the episode, he tells Phlox, "Someday my people are going to come up with some sort of a doctrine, something that tells us what we can and can't do out here, should and shouldn't do. But until somebody tells me that they've drafted that directive, there's a little pause there, I'm going to have to remind myself every day that we didn't come out here to play God. And this episode, as a prequel series, I definitely expected that Enterprise should deal with how do we get to the prime directive, and especially with the setup that the Vulcans have been holding our hand pretty much up to this point. And you even see that when he pulls T'Pol aside early in the episode to get her advice, recommendation on what they should do. And she says, well, they've already encountered two other warp-capable species, and they did seek us out, which I'm not sure if they actually sought them out in a non-warp vessel per se. Like, they weren't trailing the Enterprise, right? But they did ask for help. And she says that, you know, it seems like okay that we can do this. But how well does this story set up the need for a prime directive in your eyes?
I think this episode does a really good job. I mean, this is one of the things that I was, you know, when Enterprise was first on the air, I was hoping that they would deal with this sort of thing. And, you know, this episode comes very early in the show's run. And, you know, this is pretty much a classic prime directive dilemma that you would get in any of the shows. And it's set up very well. I kind of wish that they had Archer make the mistake of giving them warp drive or something like that to sort of, because I don't think that you, my own personal opinion on this is you sort of have to make a mistake before people realize that we shouldn't be doing something. I think it's a little, you know, it's maybe a little toothless to have T'Pol sort of tell, not tell Archer what to do, but to suggest what to do, and Phlox to sort of suggest what to do. And, you know, it makes Archer seem a little more, I think, susceptible than perhaps he should be. And then also, I think, frankly, you know, you sort of quoted his lines there about a doctrine and a directive. And that's the part of the episode that always sort of rings a little false to me. It's kind of a little too on the nose. But, you know, I think on the whole, the episode does do a pretty good job of setting it up.
You know, something that you said there bears mentioning as well, that this episode had to be rewritten right before they went and filmed it, because every script has to, I guess, be approved by the higher ups, people that go higher even than Rick Berman. And it came down that the original ending of the episode, which was Archer lets Phlox cure them.
See, I would have liked to see that.
Phlox was going to disobey Archer's orders.
He basically it's not something that some cure them, is it? He doesn't cure them. And the captain doesn't know about it. And it's kind of like he lies to the captain all the way up until the final moment. And there's never actually any kind of resolution. And it came down from up on high that is not allowed in Star Trek, that the captain has to basically be in control, and that nobody can be lying to him in his senior group. I mean, it's unacceptable to show that as as acceptable behavior.
Right.
So, and I agree with that, yeah. You know, there's certain things you should do on television, certain things you shouldn't. And Star Trek should be a moral compass. It should not be Battlestar Galactica, which shows people making mistakes.
So say we all.
It should be Star Trek, which shows people at their best.
Yeah, I think the original ending dramatically maybe would have been an interesting story, but I agree that it's not Star Trek. That's not the message of Star Trek, and certainly not in an episode that's very clearly designed as, Eric, you said, it's maybe a little bit too much on the nose with the line that I quoted from Archer there. Clearly designed to set up the prime directive, the future development of the prime directive. If you had Phlox do that at the end, it would pretty much cancel out the whole point of the episode.
I think that too would have added too much tension between Phlox and Archer, and just the overall feeling of the show and the episode, that to have that kind of disobedience, especially where you have millions of lives at stake and possibly millions more down the road. It just, I don't think that would have worked.
Yeah, I think that probably would have been too much. I mean, I don't think curing them and then having Phlox, you know, Archer would tell Phlox to cure them and, you know, he would lie about it, I think that would be too much. But, you know, I think the prime directive really draws its power and draws its strength from learning from experience and these ideas that, you know, for example, like with the Earth Romulan War that was intimated all the way back in the original series and things of this nature, where, you know, it having people become perfect in Star Trek, I think Enterprise would have been a good opportunity to show, you know, how that happened. And I think in this episode, it's perhaps a little too much like they're already perfect. You know, Archer's actions in this episode, while he's saying things about like, we need a directive, you know, he may as well be holding a sign up, you know, that says, you know, General Order 1 or something. it does just strike me as a little too much like, well, yeah, we're making a new television series and we're making a prequel, but we still need it to be exactly the same as every other Star Trek that's out there. And, you know, I think Star Trek is not that brittle. I think Star Trek can bend a little bit. And I think if Archer had done something like give them warp drive, I think that would have maybe had it be a little bit bendy and maybe something bad would happen. Maybe their ship would explode and then Archer would realize that's not great. Something like that, I think, may have worked a little better.
Yeah, the whole warp drive question was, if he had given, and they do talk about this a little bit, I mean, he and T'Pol talk about it, but if he had given them the warp technology and how to build it, they couldn't just simply suddenly have warp ships. So when the Vlakians kept saying, like, if we had a warp vessel, then everything would be easier for us, that part was sort of, I mean, I guess it sounds good for the aliens to be saying that just to make it a tough decision for Archer. But in reality, it wouldn't have changed their situation very much. They would, what are they going to do? Then fly around and spend years and years looking for a planet with someone who might be able to help them. And as Archer tells them, everyone may not want to help you. You know, they might encounter the Klingons and the Klingons will kill everyone on the ship, trace the ion trail back to Valakis, and then take over the planet. So it's not like a magic pill that would have solved their problem in the first place. And they could not have even implemented warp drive immediately.
You know, anyway. Something you said earlier was that Archer's saying it was on the nose. Someone said, I think it Eric was said, Eric that said that Archer saying that the directive was kind of on the nose. The way I looked at that was it was on the nose as well, but I instantly mitigated it in my mind just somehow with, well, you know, maybe Captain Archer writes the prime directive eventually. Be, yeah. So maybe the word directive just is what pops into his head. So he says directive then because in 15 years when he writes it for real, that's the name that's going to pop into his head. So
yeah, for me, that line worked fine. I don't think it was too much personally, but I can see where you might feel that way.
Oh, I liked it too. And so I think we're all in agreement that Eric is fired. And
well, I will say I do like that reading of it. And that, you know, if we have to have the line in the episode, you know, because the people that do Star Trek should always listen to what I say. That, you know, I think that's really smart, actually, because we do know later on in the fourth season, of course, that Archer becomes this very influential person, the founding of the Federation, and he gives this speech and all this kind of thing. And, you know, so he is kind of this founding father of the Federation, if I can use that term. So, yeah, I could see that definitely.
He's like the old Thomas Jefferson of the Federation when he goes into that last speech and, you know, he's going to start the whole. You know, we never get to see his speech, though. Kind of walks in and then they turn the holodeck off and it's like, that really? You don't even give us a line?
Well, Riker had all he needed to know. So he made his decision.
I'm sure Riker had that speech memorized. So it's probably
it's probably like we the people for them.
Yeah.
The scene where Phlox and Archer are really debating what's going on here and the twist to this episode, which we haven't brought up yet, is the fact that this is a planet where there are two sentient humanoid species who are coexisting. So you can take it to be like Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, which Phlox brings up here on Earth, if we were to have continued to live to, well, basically today. I mean, technologically, I guess we're sort of on par with where the Valakians are right now in this episode. And what did you think about Archer's reactions? Like when Phlox brings up, what if aliens had come to Earth and given, well, first Phlox says, you once shared your planet with another humanoid species. And Archer kind of blows him off. He's like, okay, go on. And he says, what if aliens had come and given the Neanderthals an evolutionary advantage? And Archer really blows that off as like, well, that that didn't happen. And here we're talking about something today, but I think Phlox has a really excellent point, something that really, really could have happened in the past and would have altered the entire course of history on Earth. I found it a little bit surprising that Archer just blew that off and was not receptive to hearing that the way he was.
Well, I think Archer's reactions are the same as probably most of the viewers are too when Phlox is first bringing this up, because your mm-hmm. first notion is to help the people, and your mm-hmm. first notion is to aid the suffering. And mm-hmm. so as soon as he says, well, maybe we shouldn't, it's kind of like a switch goes off in your brain. Well, there isn't really any good reason not to help the people. And I think that's why it takes Archer overnight to figure out a solution, because most people aren't going to hear that argument first time around and say, all right, you know, you're right, Phlox, we shouldn't help them. To Paul would, probably, because she's mostly logic. But I think Archer's reaction is actually pretty human.
You know, I really like what is in the script as well at that moment in the episode. He says, I think your compassion for this species is overriding your judgment. And Archer says, my compassion guides my judgment. Mm-hmm. And I really like that line, because I felt like that really just kind of sums everything up. That really is, we're always asking the question, what does it mean to be human? What, you know, is it consciousness? Is it this? Is it that? Your compassion. Human beings have compassion. And it really is what makes us kind of draw together and solve a problem. And I think Archer says it later in the series. He says, you know, there's one thing that human beings do better than anyone else that we've met. When we have a problem, we get together and we fix it. No matter what our difference is, we get it done. I think he's talking to the Andorian and the Tellarite delegation, and he's basically insulting them because they think being called human is being insulting. Mm-hmm. But Archer and Dear Doctor says, my compassion guides my judgment. That's why he's the right guy to be in command of the first Starfleet ship. He's got good judgment, and he's got the right kind of human compassion to be going out there, and he's going to make mistakes, but he's making good decisions with the information he has.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, that's a really interesting formulation. Compassion guides his judgment, because it could very easily be compassion is my judgment, or, you know, but it's not about being compassionate just because you want to be compassionate. It's about using that to guide what you're actually going to do. And yeah, certainly compassion is a part of that. But Archer, obviously, at the end of the day and at the end of Dear Doctor, decides that his overriding compassion for these people and wanting to help them is not the thing to do, would not be helping them ultimately, or perhaps it's not his place to do so. And so, you know, that's kind of what I like about, you know, we were talking about the Prime Directive earlier, and there's no Prime Directive now, but, you know, that's one of the things I like about the Prime Directive, is it's not really about making the right decision, but it's about declining to make a decision because right. You don't know what the decision's ultimately going to happen. So,
right. I think compassion is critical, and it is what makes us human, but there are, I don't want to say there are limits to compassion, but there are limits to the application of compassion, limits to intervention. And that's what you have to learn. And in first season Enterprise, the Archer we see through most of this episode until he comes to his decision is, I think, representing still an immature aspect of humanity as a spacefaring race when you're dealing with all these other cultures and what the Vulcans have been trying to help humans along to evolve towards is that you can't fix every problem. You can't come together to solve every problem. And there are some problems that you simply shouldn't be involved in the first place. And what's excellent about this episode is that I'm glad that they made the disease that is afflicting the Valakians a sort of genetic degeneration that's a natural process. It's not like the Mink created some sort of disease to kill off the Valakians. It's not anything like that. It's the natural evolutionary process of this planet. And then when they find out that the Mink are sort of going through, what does Phlox call it? Like an evolutionary awakening.
I think he calls it.
That they could eventually be the dominant species on this planet. Well, that's the natural course of evolution on this planet. It's just like on Earth. There have been many humanoids on this planet. But we ended up being the ones who evolved to the point where we are now. Didn't necessarily have to turn out that way, but if someone had interfered and changed the course of evolution, we wouldn't be here right now doing this show together. And I wouldn't want, as much as I'd hate to think of the idea that I wouldn't be here, I also would not want someone else interfering with nature in that way. And so the fact that they didn't make this a question of, this race is trying to kill the other one, who should we help? But rather, this is just simply what's going to happen naturally. And it's really not any of our business because it's not our planet. We should stay out of it. Makes the decision different for Archer.
So this brings up the question that has led me to the position that the idea of God is untenable, or at least one of the things that's led me here is, why would a compassionate people or being, what have you, allow needless suffering? And you think about situations like, any sort of natural situation here on Earth. You think about the bubonic plague, or you think about a natural disaster, you know, anything that could very easily kill many, if not, or the asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs, if that had been us in that time, why would a being allow that kind of suffering? And you see the same question being asked with humanity. Now that we're getting to a point where we can avoid that kind of suffering or help alleviate that suffering for another people. And it's interesting that we, as an Archer, actually choose to continue to let them go in their suffering. And I don't think that's necessarily an answer to my question about the greater concept of God, but it's the same idea.
But you mentioned something, though. You said he lets them go on suffering. At the end of the episode, he gives them the gift of the medicine, which will ease their symptoms for a decade.
Right, but that's... Yeah,
which
but,
somehow implies that they're going to be in less pain.
Right, but after a decade, you know, I mean, because the problem is, if they can't solve it, their whole race is still going to die of disease. That suffering is still going to happen eventually.
Right. Well, even lessening pain does not equal no suffering in the first place.
I mean, yeah.
They could still be suffering, and they may not be able to synthesize. Something could go wrong and they can't synthesize the drug, or they might not be able to synthesize enough to keep up with the need. It's also an interesting point here that we talked about whether Archer should make some mistakes or not. And this isn't even a black and white, like, do we interfere with this planet or do we not? Because just by giving them that, we are interfering a bit. Because if they find a cure... Well, they found a cure because we gave them what they needed in order to finally discover a solution to this problem. So we have interfered there as well. So if the Vlachians succeed within a decade and then the mink can't evolve any further, then we did change the course of evolution on that planet.
What it makes me think is that, you know, if Archer makes the decision to cure this disease, then that may be showing compassion towards that race, but it may not be showing compassion towards the Mank.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what gives the Mank the right, I guess, in this case? I mean, because the question is, I would probably side with Archer's decision, but I don't think it's necessarily right or wrong either way, either decision you could make, because there's nothing saying, and it's the whole idea too, that evolution has, you know, a path that it goes on. There's nothing saying that the mink would actually evolve larger brains and or more complex brains to become more intelligent. You know, even if they were allowed to expand and their environment changed, which is what you need for evolution, there's nothing saying that they would be able to reach that point. And so there is, I mean, it could definitely go either way.
That's actually a really good point, because they do say in the episode that the Mank are sort of dependent on this other race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they do die out, if they don't find a cure of their own volition, the Manc may also die out.
Right.
And
right.
So this may be the worst case scenario in a way.
The natural.
Right. Because if you think about it, what was it? Phlox says that they've developed a symbiotic relationship, and because they give each other something each that they need. If the Volokians do end up reducing to the point where they are no longer much of a species or become more of a subspecies, and they're just maybe a few thousand of them, the Manc are going to have to kind of elevate themselves. They're going to have to learn how to do things. They're going to have to learn how to survive. And I think that is what evolution really is. It's weeding out, and it's their survival of the fittest. So the ones who manage to grow the farms, to get the shelter, to educate themselves, to not get burned by fire, to all the things that pre-man had to learn, those are the ones that will go forth and build warp drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, the decision, it's tough because so much of the episode is about human compassion. I mean, it even starts when we started talking about movie night at the beginning, and you see Trip crying. You know, that's yeah. It's all about human emotions and compassion, and the solution here, it's you almost have to be cold about it. Like, I feel that we're out there exploring and we encounter someone and they ask us for help, but at the same time, we don't want to be playing God and we don't want to be interfering. There are many courses that the evolution could take on this planet, and I think everything you guys said, these are all possible outcomes here. And so the decision, I feel, has to be hands-off, that I feel really bad for what's happening, but it's your world, and we can't solve your problem. We could make it worse by interfering. I don't know. It just feels like we should be hands-off on it, as hard as it is for even me for me to say that, because it goes against the compassion, right? But
here's the question. If you were actually God, though, would you do something about it?
That brings in a question like, who, what is God, and who,
right? But
you,
I mean,
do?
The whole idea, I mean, of playing God, you know, it's like, if yeah. you know, because you could always take it to the next level, because they talk about in other episodes of Enterprise, in other episodes of Star Trek, you have like the Q continuum yeah. that are basically gods, you know. It's like, okay, well, so once you get humanity to that point, at what point is it okay to help?
Well, but you're talking about godlike powers versus the right. idea of God, the supreme being. See, if you were God, if you were the supreme being and you created the universe, well, they would be your creation.
Right.
And therefore, I think it would be within your right to do what you wanted, to help whichever side you wanted make the decision. Now, it doesn't make any sense that you would allow one side to suffer and the other not. But at least if you created the entire universe, then by definition, you would be within your right to do what you wanted to do with your creation. But if you're talking about the Q or the prophets or humans who evolved to the point of the Q and had godlike powers, well, that's still different because they didn't actually create those right. things in the first place.
You know, John Doe could probably help them too.
Oh, John Doe from Transfigurations?
Yeah. yeah. Just touch them. You know, he could help an entire starship with a yellow pulse of light.
Yeah. I don't know, it's a really a difficult question, interesting question for sure, but I don't really have a definitive answer.
Nobody
for that,
does. That's why it's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't feel like yeah. we're qualified to answer that question because, right. you know, it is the biggest question of all, right? Yeah. What would, in order to know what would God do, you have to have some concept of God. And part of the whole point of faith is that you really have no concept of what it really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, I think, Sebastian, at the beginning, who watches the Watchers. Right. So mm-hmm. we don't even need to evolve to the point of the Q to be seen as gods by someone else. And so the question you ask, Tommy, is that from the perspective of the other side, maybe we are the gods, and why aren't we helping them? Right.
Right. But I'm.
Well, have you, like in Who Watches the Watchers, mm-hmm. he talks about, you know, what have I done? You, what have I done? Have I angered you? Mm-hmm. And it's like, maybe. You know, is it because I did this or because I did that? And my wife died last summer. Could you bring her back to me? Mm-hmm. No, that's beyond my power. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, why won't you do this for me? I'll give you my life in return. I mean, he's trying to communicate on that level of, mm-hmm. what do you call it? Like, like a tribal kind of religion level, like where you make sacrifices. It's like, I'll give you my life for her life. Yeah. And if that started happening in this Enterprise episode, you know, where if they started saying to Captain Archer, you know, we'll give you 500,000 of our people if you'll give us this cure.
But the Valakians are too advanced
for
that, I think. But the Mink aren't necessarily. Right. So if the Mink were the only humanoids on this planet, then maybe they might react that way. But of course, their interaction with the Valakians has let them know that just because you have that technology doesn't mean you have those powers, I think. Yeah. Well, let's wrap up with just final thoughts here before we do final thoughts on the episode. Final thoughts on the decisions made. I mean, where do we stand on this in the end, both Archer and Phlox's decisions?
I think that they're probably the only decisions that ultimately could be made, at least for Star Trek. And, you know, we, of course, as people that like Star Trek, have seen so much Star Trek, you know, before this. And so this is not something that will surprise, I think, anybody who's familiar with Star Trek, that these are the decisions that come out, because these are the decisions that Star Trek does come up with usually. But like I said before, I think that the episode may have been a little bit more interesting, or there may have been a little bit more meat to it if one of the decisions had been made differently. I definitely don't think that curing the disease would have been a decision that would have made the episode more interesting. I think that would have guided the show on a probably a darker path than they would have intended it to go. But I do think that there was room for Archer to make a different decision with warp drive or something else that perhaps would have made the episode a little more, like I said, meaty.
I think that it's a really good example of Star Trek, because something that Star Trek does really well is it presents a third alternative. So will we help them or won't we? Or what's that third thing? The third thing is we'll give them something to help them, but they have to figure it out for themselves, which is the ultimate lesson. And Star Trek does this really well. They did. And this is, I think, one of the best examples of a Star Trek ship visiting somewhere and not solving all of their problems, where Captain Kirk would go and say, well, you're not doing things the way we do them, and you should fix that and just leave. Captain Archer says, well, you're not doing things the way you should. We're going to help you a little bit. Captain Picard says, the Prime Directive says we can't do this. So we're going to hide the duck blind, and we're not going to make ourselves known to them. Oh, now we have to, because, you know, circumstances have made that happen. So, you know, as time goes through Star Trek, you see the various captains having to solve things with the information they're given, which kind of goes back to what I said before. Archer is dealing with this with all the information he's got. He's a smart guy. He's a diplomatic guy. He is the guy for this mission. And he's out there making the best choice he can. You know, he's got people that are smart advising him. He's got Dr. Phlox, who's got this alien perspective, and T'Pol, who has the alien perspective, the super intelligent Vulcan perspective, and he makes a decision based on his compassion. And his compassion ultimately says, I don't have the right to deal with this. And I think, you know, that he says, my compassion guides my judgment. I think that should be kind of like the slug line for this episode.
What about you, Tommy?
Well, I still don't know where I would fall on what decision I would make, but it's interesting that Enterprise isn't the only thing that dealt with this, because we saw this too in Into Darkness, with Kirk wanting to save the people on the volcano planet on the Bureau. And I think Archer at first in this episode has reactions very much like Kirk when he says, oh, big deal, they saw us, so what? Because we all have this idea of the compassion guiding us, where it's okay if we make a few missteps along the way, as long as we, you know, get in there to help the people. It's a tough decision. And I suppose logically Archer made the right choice in the end, because the best things we learn are things that we figure out for ourselves. And this episode, I think, did a really good job showing that.
Yeah, I think for me, too, within the context of this episode, I think he made the right decision and made the Star Trek decision. Maybe I feel that the right decision, as I said earlier, would be to just move along and not get involved at all. But I think the Star Trek decision was to do that with the one difference of giving them a little something to help them ease their pain and maybe find a solution for themselves later on. I think that makes it Star Trek as opposed to just some other science fiction.
It's also the more compassionate thing to do, too, without totally right. going all the way.
Right, exactly. And I think that Phlox made the right decision in telling Archer that he had found a cure because he had considered not telling him. So I think they both made the right decisions within the context of the episode. But as we discussed, what is truly the right decision in this situation is something that it's really hard to actually come up with an answer for. So as for final thoughts on the episode and a rating, Sebastian, quick final thought on the overall episode and a rating.
Let's see. I really like how at the end of this episode, they kind of sum it up with Dr. Phlox saying, you know, I came very close to misjudging him. I gave him the information. And something I noticed as somebody who has been on television and film sets and watched how this stuff is done is right at the end of the episode when Archer is giving the whatever it is that's going to help them for the next 10 years, Phlox is standing behind him. And it's kind of symbolic a little bit, probably, where the director said, okay, this is where you are because you're standing behind the captain's decision. You're with him. You're part of this. He's not off to the left. He's not off to the right. He's behind him. And he's supporting the captain in his decision.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what we needed it to come to. We needed them to come to that common ground where Archer understood what had to happen and Phlox understood Archer's point of view because he's realizing throughout this whole episode what humans are like, from their dogs to their teeth and all this stuff. And he's getting all that information like a snowball, and he can use that finally to communicate with Archer and make the right choice. I'll give it 3.5 out of 5. DNA sample tubes.
Okay, excellent. What about you, Eric?
I think for me, you know, you had mentioned earlier in the episode, Chris, about how you would put Dear Doctor in your top 25 or 30 Star Trek episodes. And, you know, I think for me, it probably wouldn't get a spot in my top 25. It might get a spot in my top 100. But that has more, I think, to do with my sort of, I guess, prejudice against Enterprise than anything else. But you know, this is a really strong episode of Enterprise. I think it's a good episode of Star Trek, but it also, for me, encapsulates sort of where the show went wrong and, you know, sort of like just treating it as an extension of the 24th century as opposed to trying to show a more fallible humanity and a more fallible Starfleet. So, you know, I think in that sense, it is a little of a failure for me, but as an episode of Star Trek, I think it's really good. So I would probably give it a 2.5 out of 5.
All right. How about you, Tommy?
Well, I like this episode a lot. And because I don't ever see anything get a 5 out of 5, and I don't often know why, I'm actually going to give it 5 liters of warp plasma. And the simple reason is because nothing is ever going to be quote unquote perfect, but I'd like to think a 5 out of 5 is attainable for some things. And there aren't really any gripes I have with this. Maybe something nitpicky, like maybe they could have used Malcolm and Trip more, though I don't know how you would ever do that in this story, especially with a 40 minute time window. So I think they set out to do what they wanted to do. And they told a story that has allowed us to talk about it for over an hour now without coming to any sort of conclusion. And I think that is what sets it above from other stories, not necessarily just in Star Trek, but in general. So I give this a 5 out of 5.
Well, for me, I think in contrast to what Eric said, I think this episode finds the right balance of making it feel familiar within the Star Trek universe for fans, while at the same time showing a more immature humanity who's trying to find their way as they explore the galaxy, and they're starting to realize that there are decisions they have to make that they didn't anticipate, and how are they going to make those decisions. And I think that it very much has the core of Star Trek in place. The decision that they come to is true to Star Trek, but very difficult for our crew as well. So again, I think it's one of the best Star Trek episodes, personally, and I think it's well-written, well-acted. There are a few things you might have done differently, but it's really excellent. So I'm actually going to give this, I'm going to go with you, Tommy, but I'm going to double your rating system. Ooh. And give this 10 evolutionary paths.
Good one.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Before we go, Sebastian, tell people where they can find you and what you have going on.
I have a few things going on right now. You can find me on Twitter. It's just at Sebastian Pruth, SebastianProoth. You can find me on Twitter and follow me and see what I'm doing there. You will find that I'm working on a new Star Trek series called Star Trek Shadows of Tyranny, which is an audio series based entirely in the Mirror Universe, directly following on to the events of Mirror Mirror, and how Spock changes everything because of his conversation with Captain Kirk. And of course, you can find me at Star Trek The Continuing Mission, StarTrekContinuingMission.com, and you will find 8 audio dramas on there from the last few years. And you can check out those and let us know what you think.
Excellent. And people can hear you on some other episodes here on the network as well of The Ready Room and Warp 5.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've been had a chance to be on the show a few times. I should also mention that Shadows of Tyranny is coming out before the end of 2014. And you should also be looking for a new episode of Continuing Mission before the end of 2014 as well.
Excellent. How about you, Eric? Where can people find you?
Well, they can find me on Twitter. I tweet at Eric Brasier, ericbrasure. And they can also find my podcast I do with my co-host Richard Goodness at trekaboutshow.com. And we are on a 7-year mission to turn Richard into a Trekkie, beginning from the original series. So we'll see how that goes.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Tommy, I am glad Sebastian and Eric could join us today. I'm glad you could join us as well, especially because this is an Enterprise show.
Well, thank you for having me. I always love to take a break from working on my Enterprise project to come and talk about Enterprise, just to make my life a little more Enterprise-oriented.
Not that it's not already Enterprise-oriented, right? Since you spend all your waking time creating your Enterprise film, Star Trek Horizon.
Yes, literally, pretty much all my waking time on that. So thank you for having me. I do appreciate that, by the way.
Definitely. And it's always great to have someone on who really knows and appreciates Enterprise as well, because this series is probably, for us assembling panels on the Ready Room to have really good constructive discussion of the show, Enterprise is the hardest one to pull together.
That's too bad, because it's such a good show. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of Trekkies who haven't given it a chance since over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I know for myself that I liked it when it was first on, but not nearly as much as I like it now when I went back and started rewatching it. And exactly. It became my favorite show. So I'm happy to talk about it.
And more people are finding that out now. And so I do find that as each year goes by, it's a little bit easier to pull together Enterprise panels. So I think, 10 years from now, no problem.
Yeah, well, in 10 years, the Velakians will hopefully have found a cure, too. So all things, yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to get uncomfortable there on their homeworld. So,
yeah.
Well, it was great fun and very interesting and enlightening for me to talk about Dear Doctor with all you guys today. But it's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Everything that we do has to exist inside of this little box. this window,
yeah,
if you will.
Right. And you can do whatever you want inside there, but once you step outside, you know, it's the real world.
Earl Grey.
That's, you know what I mean? And then Star Trek V is all about crapping all over the rest of the movies that just came out.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When you're in the edit bay, as soon as you put one image next to another, it's this instant gratification. It's this great creative jolt, which happens every time you start juxtaposing your images. And when you start seeing things fall into place, it's really galvanizing and it's really thrilling, actually. And I love feeding off that kind of energy.
The Ready Room.
Well, you know, time is not really linear, Char. So the monkey, he's always been there and he always will be.
Oh. I take the Janeway stance on time travel. It gives me a headache.
The Orb.
Batman also creates a contingency plan for all the other superheroes just in case something goes wrong with them. So
what does he do for the Wonder Twins, for example? Like, how's he going to take them out?
I think he just separates them internally so they can't smack their hands together.
To the journey! We have like a whole bunch of geek aliens, like they're wearing their own superhero t-shirts, they're eating Hot Pockets, they have headphones on, and they're all in their own little, you know, 24th century room, but they're like, dude, I totally just pwned the Voyager. Commentary, Trek Stars.
And underlines the goal of Prexy Gail Berman to re-energize the pipeline while revitalizing the PAR brand with top-tier talents such as Abrams. I love trains.
You have
no idea
what you're saying at this point.
Warp 5.
He can put her mind at ease about these kinds of things because he can just, you know how Trip is. Like, let's have some catfish and, like, just hang out. You know,
I was just thinking that.
Continuing mission.
We actually spoke with CBS legal team, and that was one of the things that we had told them, is that all of our visuals were all original scenes. All of our animation was going to be original. All of our music would be original. So we would not be stealing any content from the original era. Mm-hmm. And they liked that a lot.
Literary Treks.
And I just love that because it is very true. You know, Picard in some ways kind of has that Yoda-ness about him where he will kind of speak in a riddle and he wants you to figure it out.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. We're all over the place. Just search for Trek.fm or the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. Be sure to subscribe to the Master Feed as well. This is a special feed that contains every episode of every show that we do in one feed. We also have some special content in there from time to time. Like right now, we have a commentary track for the 2009 Star Trek film by Mike from Commentary Trek Stars, and that's only available there in the Master Feed. We also have some other new feeds coming out because, again, the amount of content we have is getting out of hand. Tommy, do you know that we have more than 1,000 podcast episodes on the network right now?
I did not know that. That's insane. Podcasts.
I know. We've been doing this for more than 3.5 years, going on 4 years, and it adds up.
Yeah.
We produce every single day like we do. And therefore, it is becoming very difficult to find older episodes and especially specific topics or things like commentaries or interviews or when Larry Nemechek is on to talk, because fans love to hear Larry talk. So we're creating some additional feeds that pull those episodes out and put them in one location for you. So you can subscribe to those as well if you want to find really specialized content. So watch for those coming to iTunes and Stitcher and other places soon. We've also had our reviews promotion going on, which we tell you about every week. That has now ended. And as we do record these shows a bit ahead of the release dates, the winners, you may know who you are by now. Winners will be contacted soon, but the reviews promotion has ended. We'll run another one sometime later in the year, but we do encourage everyone to drop by iTunes and Stitcher anyway and leave us reviews of the shows. Those mean a lot to us because we love to hear from you and hear what you think, and it also helps other Star Trek fans find the shows as they search for Star Trek podcasts, because we have a great audience and we have a big audience, but I would say 99% plus of Star Trek fans still have never heard of Trek FM. So help us out by leaving reviews. And speaking of that, we'd like to share a few reviews with you here this week. we have a review from A91R8H8. Tommy, do you have any idea what that means?
I have no clue.
Neither do I. Maybe it's an Android designation. I don't know. But whatever it means, they've left us a 5-star review that says, "Can't live without my Trek FM. I've been listening to some of Trek FM's podcasts since early last year. I listen to them while I'm driving on my way to and from school. I find myself so engrossed in the conversation, and I wish I was there. The people who work on this podcast are real Trekkies slash Trekkers too, making the conversation all that more interesting because of their knowledge of Trek lore." So thank you so much for that review. We really, really appreciate that. And also we have a review from SciFiFan203, who left us 5 stars, said, "Great podcast. This podcast is a must listen for any Star Trek fan. The Ready Room covers all the Star Trek shows and movies. Short and sweet, to the point, but I think a great description of the show, and that will definitely help people who see it decide to give us a listen."
And in case you were wondering, his name means he is the 203rd sci-fi fan.
Okay, great. So he was early on.
Right.
Definitely early
because
on.
You didn't know what the other guy was. I decided to help you out with this one.
Thank you.
No problem.
But think about how many sci-fi fans there are.
Right.
So he is right there at the ground level.
I'm 202, so ha.
Oh, okay. Is that what you're going to change your name to when you decide not to be Doggy Dog anymore?
Right. Well, I don't know if I could ever leave that one behind, but you know. I'll keep this as my, as like my, I don't like to brag, so that'll
what
be
would
my
be
secret
great
status.
Would be if you were Tommy G Doggy Dog 202, and there were 201 other, yeah.
No, because I was the first Tommy G Doggy Dog, so that, I can't let that go.
Okay, hang on to that.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, we have one more review for you today, and this one is from Podcast Connoisseur, who left us 5 stars and said, "Great insight, very entertaining. So I just discovered Trek FM, and The Ready Room is the only cast I've listened to so far, and I'm loving it. With so many revolving points of view, I'm always discovering something new about episodes that I've seen over and over again. It's thoughtful and insightful. I love it." Well, thank you so much for that. And that is one of the things that we try to do here on The Ready Room, is to have many different guests every week so that the viewpoints are always changing. So we're glad that is connecting with you as well. And we do have more reviews. I'll read some more on a future show. And thank you, everyone, for sharing your thoughts with us and for helping us get word out there in iTunes and on Stitcher. Now, Tommy, when you're not, you know, going down to have brunch with the Mink and the great food that they get from the Valakians,
right,
where can people find you, find out more about what's going on, and also find out more about Horizon?
The main two places are StarTrekHorizon.com and Facebook.com/STHorizon, or you can just search on Facebook for Star Trek Horizon. Real quick, Star Trek Horizon is an independent film set during the Enterprise era, specifically in 2160, and it deals with a lot of the events in the Romulan War, and it wraps up a lot of unfinished storylines in Enterprise. This is a full-length feature shot here in Michigan. And we did a Kickstarter, got 200% of our Kickstarter goal, so that was really great. And we're hoping to have a new trailer out within the next few weeks, so look for that. Keep apprised with the Facebook page and with our official website.
Excellent. Yeah, the stuff you put out so far looks fantastic. And as I say every time you're on, I just love the fact that you decided in making a film like this that you were going to focus on the Enterprise time period.
Well, thank you. It's partly because it's the period that means the most to me, and also because I think it's not seen enough in the Trek fandom and in fan films. There's a lot of original series focused stuff and a fair amount of 24th century stuff. So it's been really nice to be able to kind of boldly go where no one has gone before.
Yeah, definitely. And as we've talked about throughout the show today, for those of you who have seen Prelude to Axanar and you love that, Tommy is one of the people behind that as well, as we talked about doing the compositing. And go check out his model of the NX-04 Discovery digital model. I mean, that is just absolutely beautiful work.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I spent literally hundreds of hours on that model to try and get it right and as accurate as possible, down to the detail of painting every single hull panel in Photoshop individually to make sure that they matched the ones on the show model. So it has been a labor of love.
Well, you can tell. I mean, all the work really shows off there.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, if you would like to share some feedback on today's show, there are a number of ways you can do that. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to me by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is trekfm. Oh, Tommy, did we give your Twitter handle, actual handle, not the one we were just making?
No, we didn't. My Twitter handle is Tommy G Dog. That's Tommy, T-O-M-M-Y, G, D-A-W-G. Okay. And that's because I'm a G-dog, man. So
great. Yes, that's the real handle. It's not actually doggy dog. That's one he used to use before.
Yeah, right. Why not?
All right, so that's Tommy's Twitter handle. And the network is Trek FM. And then we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. We have a community on G+. We have forums at trek.fm/forums. You can also send us a voicemail. If you look on the show page on our website in the left sidebar, you'll see where you can do that. Or go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. And all you need is the microphone on your webcam or on your smartphone or your tablet. And you can upload the message to us right from there. And then if you'd like to find me, I'm on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/CBrianJones. I do lots of other shows on the network, The Orb, Literary Treks, Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Matter Stream, Hyper Channel, and I co-host the official Star Trek Axanar podcast with Alec Peters. So check that one out as well. I'm all over the place. And you can find out what I'm talking about in many other parts of the Star Trek franchise. And also, don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/TrekFM, patreon.com/TrekFM. Head over there, see what our current goals are, see what you'll get in exchange for your support, and make a contribution to us. And these are monthly contributions that you can make. It's really easy, and it means so much to us, and it really does help us keep the shows. It not only helps us keep the shows coming to you, we really need the support in order to keep the shows coming to you. So please go check that out, patreon.com/TrekFM. And I'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice by going to audibletrial.com/TrekFM. Head over, pick up this great book, Shatner Rules. You really are. If you like William Shatner, you're going to love this one. And you can get it absolutely free, audibletrial.com/TrekFM. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. Well, Tommy, that is everything that we have for the listeners today. I'm going to head on down and see if Hoshi can give me some Denobulan lessons.
Well, hopefully she does a good job teaching you Denobulan, and you can make sure not to get your washboards confused with your nostrils. And with that, it's time to stick a Denobulan in it, because the Ready Room is done!